Thanks, Victoria, and thanks to all of you for attending. I'm happy to be able to present on an area that's got far better evidence than in bronchiolitis, where there's a lot less controversy. And I'd just like to start off by introducing you to this young boy, Charlie. I looked after Charlie last year in the emergency department, and I still remember him. And I remember him because he had what you could call the look. He had the look of a child who's actually really unwell. And I also remember him because not only did he have the look, his mum had the look. And she had the look of a parent who knew her child was unwell but wanted reassurance. And I knew I couldn't give it to her. This is an interesting paradox when you come into the emergency department with a sick child. You want to be seen quickly, but you don't want to be seen quickly because that means your child's actually seriously unwell. So Charlie's mum was actually concerned because he was seen at triage by one of our experienced nurses, brought through to the resuscitation bay, and we attended to him immediately. And that's usually not a good sign when you come into the ED. So we immediately had to make some decisions about stopping and talking to mom about what was going on or attending immediately to Charlie. And he looked unwell enough for us to need to attend to him immediately. So while we're getting all our stuff together, getting oxygen on, getting IV access, getting cultures, blood gas, administering antibiotics, it's running through my mind that the next step is to administer a fluid bolus to Charlie, and he's got respiratory distress, he's undifferentiated. I'm not sure if that's the right thing to do for him. And this is a clinical conundrum that affects me, and I'm sure a lot of you, on an almost daily basis. And that's what this talk is about. How do we make the assessment of the child that we think has sepsis and we want to administer fluid to? We're going to see Charlie at the end of the talk again, and we'll make a decision together about whether to administer fluid. So the title of this talk is how to perform a fluid assessment in sepsis. And I challenge you to actually try to imagine what a fluid assessment actually means when we're talking about septic children. I get in bronchiolitis, fluid assessment means having some idea what their intake is like. If they're getting more than half of what they should be getting, they should be okay. I get in gastroenteritis, a fluid assessment is checking their intake versus their output. That makes sense. What is a fluid assessment in sepsis? Most of the kids we see with sepsis haven't had any fluid loss. And so the question that we're actually asking is, should I administer a fluid bolus? Why do we administer fluid for sepsis when there's been no volume loss? As a form of shock, we think of sepsis as being an imbalance between oxygen demand and oxygen delivery. And we can address some features of oxygen demand by decreasing fever and providing sedation and even mechanical ventilation. And we can increase oxygen delivery by administering oxygen and sometimes transfusing blood or blood packed cells. But the equation very quickly boils down to increasing oxygen delivery by increasing cardiac output. So what we're really doing by administering fluid in sepsis is increasing cardiac output so we can increase oxygen delivery. So why wouldn't you do it? Makes sense. You give fluid, it increases cardiac output, it increases oxygen delivery in a setting where we think oxygen delivery is impaired in the first place. And the reason we hesitate or are a little bit reluctant in some circumstances to administer fluid is that there's good randomized evidence, in fact, better evidence than the observational studies that underscore our current practice, that administering fluid in sepsis is harmful in some settings. And I'm referring in specific to the FEAST study, which I'm sure you've all heard of, which took place in sub-Saharan Africa. It was published in 2011, and it still hasn't resulted in any significant change in our sepsis management in the Western setting. And it's really hard to ignore the results of the FEAST study, because despite all the criticisms that have been raised against it and generalizing it to our population, there was no patient group that benefited from fluid administration in the FEAST study. And there was a dose effect. So the more fluid that was administered, the more harm, and we're talking about mortality, that study participants was the study participants' outcome. So there's good randomized evidence that in some settings, fluid bolus administration can be harmful. The other thing that we should pay heed to is that there is good observational evidence that a positive cumulative fluid balance, and most of that fluid is administered in the resuscitative phase of care, is associated with increased morbidity, meaning hospital, ICU length of stay, requirement for renal replacement, days on a ventilator, and mortality. So there's a very real possibility that one of our standard therapies for sepsis is in fact harmful. So when we're making the assessment as clinicians about whether to administer fluid or not, we're going to go through three different modalities that we can use to perform that fluid assessment. So firstly, patient history, secondly, patient examination, and then some bedside extended examinations that may be helpful. So first of all, on patient history, obviously, input and outtake and output is important, but again, most of the children that we see in the Western setting don't have severe dehydration leading to shock. That's maybe more common in a developing world setting, but not in our setting. What we're really doing with our history taking is putting in our mind this patient in a different risk group. So if you have central venous access device, if you're immunosuppressed, if you're very young, those patients are a higher risk group. And when we think about sepsis in the acute setting, it's always a presumptive diagnosis, and we're looking at risk stratification. So is this patient highly likely to have a bad outcome or not highly likely to have a bad outcome? And that has some direct bearing on our decision to administer therapies like fluid. The second thing we might do is talk about red flags. And that may mean in a patient with a central venous access device, whether they've been accessed in the last 24 hours. It may mean in an oncology patient if they've had chemotherapy within the last 10 days, et cetera. History taking has limitations. Obviously, the risk of having a high, the risk of having sepsis doesn't equal sepsis. It's still more common in patients with fever and risk of neutropenia that they have a self-limited viral infection rather than severe, a serious bacterial infection. So a lot of the things that we gain on history taking are nonspecific. So the second thing you might do is examine the patient. And when we examine the patient, our fluid assessment is actually an examination for signs of shock. It's not looking at intravascular, it's not looking at the venous volume or venous capacitance. It's looking at signs of shock, so inadequate perfusion. So the things we're going to look at are all the things you look at in your regular clinical practice: heart rate, capillary refill time, blood pressure, respiratory rate, oxygen saturations, conscious state. And the thing that we worry about as clinicians is persistently abnormal vital signs, multiple abnormal vital signs, or individual vital signs that are extremely abnormal. And it's worth mentioning also that when we assess a patient for signs of shock, we should also be assessing them for signs that fluid may not be the best treatment for to address their shock. And so if you accompany your assessment for shock with an assessment for volume overload or cardiac failure, and the two things that are talked about are hepatomegaly and the presence of rails, those are also important things to include in your examination. The limitations with our physical examination is that some vital signs are numbers, and some of them are subjective. So even capillary refill time is subjective, conscious state is subjective. a lot of the vital signs we look at are prone to confounding. So the first thing we do when we bring a sick patient into the resuscitation area is to remove them from their parents, take their clothes off, put them in a cold environment, and surround them with strangers and poke them with sharp things. So it's little wonder that they are tachycardic, mottled, and irritable when we do our initial assessment. And the last thing is that all the vital signs, individually and in combination, that make up what are called the SIRS, or systemic inflammatory response syndrome criteria, have a very poor ability to differentiate between self-limited viral infections and sepsis. So we send about 85% of kids home that meet SIRS criteria for sepsis from the emergency department without antibiotics. So meeting SIRS criteria is a common presentation for patients to the ED. And the converse is also true. So about 30% of patients admitted to the intensive care unit with clinician-diagnosed sepsis do not meet SIRS criteria for sepsis, and they have a high associated mortality. So our physical examination is important, but it does have limitations. That brings us to the third part of our examination, and this is what I would call an extended examination using point-of-care ultrasound. And the intention of using point-of-care ultrasound is to try and place the patient in front of you on the Frank-Starling curve. and decide if they are in the green zone here, where they're on the steep portion of the Frank-Starling curve, and if you administer fluid, they're likely to increase their cardiac output. Remember, that was our intention of administering fluid in the first place. Or if they're on the red side of the curve, where on the flat portion of the Frank-Starling curve, we're administering fluid will serve only to increase their right atrial pressure and their venous pressures and won't have the intended effect of increasing cardiac output. So just to go through the logistics of doing this, the first thing that can be done at the bedside is a lung ultrasound. This is a linear array probe placed in the midclavicular line, the anterior chest, right side and left side. And you can see on your screen left, two black circles at the top of the screen. Those are ribs, and in between them there's a bright white line that looks like it's shimmering back and forth. That's the pleural line, and that's a normal lung. On your screen right, there are the same black circles representing the ribs, and the pleural line on that side has a bunch of white lines extending from the pleural line down to the far field of the screen. And those are called B lines. And those are consistent with a number of different diagnoses like interstitial fibrosis and things that are uncommon in children. And it's also consistent with cardiogenic pulmonary edema. So if those B lines are present in patients that you're administering fluid resuscitation for sepsis in, that may be a patient group that is operating on the flat portion of the Frank-Starling curve and may not benefit from fluid administration. The second thing that we can look at on ultrasound is the inferior vena cava. So this is a direct look at the patient's physiology and at their venous capacitance. So it's a sub-xiphoid view using a phased array transducer, and the patient on your screen left has a collapsing inferior vena cava that's small in diameter, and the patient on your screen right has a dilated and fixed inferior vena cava. So the patient on the left may benefit from fluid administration. The patient on the right may not. They're already full. The last thing we can look at on ultrasound is the heart itself. So this is, a cardiac probe, a phased array transducer that's placed in the left parasternal, it's called a left parasternal view. And you can tell on your screen left, the heart looks hyperdynamic. It's kind of like, give me more fluid. And the heart on your screen right looks like it's not functioning very well. So you can imagine that the heart on your screen right, your screen left, may be on the ascending portion of the Frank-Starling curve, and the heart on your screen right may be on the flat portion of the Frank-Starling curve. So if we put all these things together, this is a three-week-old baby, comes into your emergency department or that you see on the ward, previously well. They've not had any previous fluid administration, and they have vital signs consistent with sepsis. You're clinically concerned that they have sepsis. Your clinical examination findings are as you see there, and you perform an ultrasound of their lungs, IVC, and heart, and you find that their lungs look dry, their IVC looks collapsing, and their heart looks hyperdynamic. This is the type of patient that may benefit from fluid bolus administration, so they may be operating on the ascending portion of their Frank-Starling curve and have an increase in cardiac output with fluid bolus administration. Compare that with this patient, who's 13 months old, has a background of chronic lung disease, is febrile and has abnormal vital signs, as you see there, and is seriously unwell. You've already administered 60 mL per kilo of fluid, and you're about to intubate. The lung ultrasound findings are as you can see them. So there are multiple what are called of the B lines that are suggestive of some interstitial edema. The IVC looks like it's dilated and fixed, and the cardiac function looks impaired. So this patient is probably operating on the flat portion of the Frank-Starling curve and maybe the type of patient that would benefit from another intervention rather than fluid bolus administration. And the intervention that you'd consider in this case is a peripherally administered inotrope infusion before you intubate the patient. So as with history examination and ultrasound, along with those other two, ultrasound does have some limitations. At the moment, it's unclear in patients who are being administered fluid resuscitation at what point after it's administered the B lines that we saw start to appear, and if they're an adequate kind of stop point to decide to move to another type of therapy to support the circulation. Inferior vena cava collapsibility on its own has poor test characteristics for predicting fluid responsiveness or an increase in cardiac output after fluid is administered. That's because there are a lot of contextual factors that need to be taken into account, like right atrial pressure, the changes, the work of breathing, or the changes in intrathoracic pressure with respiration, the tone or compliance of the inferior vena cava, and intra-abdominal pressure. And lastly, and this is really important, it's unclear at the moment how long after you administer fluid, even in patients who have a positive response to fluid bolus administration, i.e. their cardiac output increases, how long that response is sustained for. And the evidence that we have right now is that that effect lasts for about an hour or less than an hour. So all of these assessment tools are used to decide whether or not this patient's going to increase their cardiac output after fluid bolus administration, and even in those that do increase their cardiac output, the majority of those will have a cardiac output that's returned down to baseline within an hour. So that should give us pause for thought whether or not this is a therapy that we should be pursuing in the first place. So let's go back to Charlie and get a little bit more information from his mother. He's a previously well boy, he's had all his normal vaccinations. He's been unwell for a few days with a flu-like illness, just like many other members of his family. Examination findings, he's febrile, tachypneic, tachycardic, as you see there, all consistent with sepsis. You look at his heart, his lungs, inferior vena cava and heart. He looks like he has some B lines in his lungs. That makes you suspect that there's something abnormal going on in his lungs. He's got a fixed and dilated inferior vena cava. That's pathological. And when you look at his heart, he's got a large pericardial effusion and he's got poor cardiac function. And so Charlie has influenza B myocarditis and an associated pericardial effusion. The treatment for him, he may actually respond to fluid at this stage in his treatment, but the treatment for him is to relieve his obstructive shock and drain the fluid in his pericardium. So in summary, as clinicians, we're using a lot of information that's available to us at the bedside to try and make decisions about fluid bolus administration. And we need to decide for the individual patient whether fluid may be beneficial or may be harmful. And all of the tools at our disposal, including history, examination, and ultrasound, have limitations. But it's the synthesis and integration of those that make us good bedside clinicians when we're making these treatment decisions for sick children. Thank you.
All right, anyone who might have a question, I'm sorry I missed one before, but if you want to come up to the microphone as well. But I'll ask first, Mel, comments or thoughts or other questions?
Yeah, I think you answered some of the questions that came through your later stages of your talk. And there was basically a lot of love for your love for POCUS as a tool for extended fluid assessment, but I suspect that was coming from the front row.
I might channel some of them with a question because my POCUS enthusiast friends also tell me there's a lot of fallibility with interpretation, operator performance, and you know this is difficult in adults. It can be particularly difficult in children. What's your kind of thoughts about you know how we pull this together consistently across a range of providers with variable skills?
Yeah, I mean it's a fantastic question, and I think you know there is a lot of difference in uptake in ultrasound in different parts of Australia and the world and departments, and the idea of credentialing and quality assurance is a major issue that we're facing with the introduction of point-of-care ultrasound everywhere. It is coming. It's being taught in medical schools, and so it's something that, as clinicians, it's something worth considering or taking on board, but it's extremely important that if you are learning how to do point-of-care ultrasound, that you do it in a kind of controlled way, that your scans are supervised and recorded, and that they're audited periodically. That goes for us as individuals and as departments. It is an operator-dependent technology, and as with all operator-dependent technologies, is fallible. So one other thing just to say is that it's important to know the limitations of ultrasound, and it's not uncommon to have an uninterpretable study, and that's not wrong.
Like a true researcher, you kept your kind of suggestions very precise and what you could base it on, but I'm going to ask you for a bit more guesswork.
Yeah.
Which way do you think we're mostly getting it wrong? Too much, too little? And what's your thoughts about how this actually plays out in practice?
In terms of fluid administration period? Well, I guess if you were to look at, sepsis, and you hadn't gone through the last 20 years of bad evidence about different therapies being used or not used, and you could start afresh right now. It's a disease characterized by, we think, organ dysfunction related to poor organ perfusion, and it's also characterized by systemic inflammation. And we're essentially pouring fluid into a leaky tank, and that leakiness is causing a lot of the harm that we observe. So I think if you could design a therapy that interrupted the leakiness, and there is some work on so-called metabolic resuscitation with vitamin C, hydrocortisone, and thiamine, that may reduce the leakiness of capillaries, that may mean that you're administering fluid into a less leaky system. And the other thing that we should and are actively looking into is the timing of inotropes in sepsis. So after how much fluid should you start an inotrope? And that's one of the fundamental differences between sepsis management in the Western setting and what was performed in the FEAST study, because we're not deciding whether to give fluid or no fluid, we're deciding whether to give fluid or an inotrope. And it's unclear at what stage, after 20 mil, you know, after zero fluid, or after 20 mils per kilo, after 40 mils per kilo, after 60 mils per kilo, we should be initiating another form of circulatory support.
I think your PhD's got plenty of legs.
It's raised more questions.
Were there any Twitter comments about vitamin C? There must have been.
There wasn't. I don't think people are that quick on Twitter, but there was
Where's
a question
Paul
about...
Where's Paul? We need him.
There was a question about whether you're going to think we're going to move the way of the adult world in sepsis in pediatrics, where we go to much earlier pressors.
Much earlier
pressors.
Yeah, I mean, there is quite a bit of variation, again, between countries, states, and cities with respect to how much fluid to administer before starting a vasopressor. An inotrope probably is the more common thing in children. Mm. But I think the trend is that, if you looked 5 years ago even, we were administering 60 mils per kilo at a minimum, up to 200 mils per kilo before we think about starting an inotrope. Now, at 40 mils per kilo, we're starting to think, is this the right therapy? Should I be switching modalities, or should I continue with my fluid resuscitation? So I think, you know, in parallel to the adult literature, we're slowly decreasing the amount of fluid that we're comfortable administering in sepsis in children.
Right, watch this space, and could you please join me in thanking Elliot Long again?